Central Neighborhood Health Foundation, also known as CNCHF, is a full-service Medicare-certified provider with access points in Los Angeles and San Bernardino County. Founded in 1967, our guiding principle for nearly five decades has been the efficient and effective delivery of culturally competent care to our patient community. And without further ado, you folks know how I like to do it. Without further ado, we're going to bring in Dr. Julie, Outreach Director at Central Neighborhood Health Foundation, who will facilitate and introduce today's guests and the hot topics. So without further ado, and no plus and no muss, come on, Dr. Julie, it's on you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome again. We're living in rapidly changing times, and the principle of acceleration is in full effect. Well, you know, I've been trying to skip the COVID-19 issue and the report, but Secretary Mayorkas tested positive this morning for COVID-19 after taking the test as part of her routine pre-travel protocols. And so now we've also heard the tragic news of General Colin Powell, the first Black U.S. Secretary of State, whose leadership was impeccable, a man to be respected, and many within the ranks of the military as well as the political community, they looked up to him as a mentor and quite a witness for the truth. So as much as we really don't want to talk about COVID, it just seems to be in our lives and continues to be part of our lives. And we're not going to spend much time on this. But, you know, I have with me Dr. Enrico Melson. And Dr. Enrico Melson is just a wealth of knowledge. He's encyclopedic. And, you know, I'm not going to belabor the idea of COVID-19, but it just seems to be lingering. It's just with us. And so, Dr. Melson, what do you see in regard to our future, the dissipation or the extinguishing of this virus? What do you think about this?
Well, you know, that's one of those you have to take a slow, long, deep breath first. And then measure your words very, very, very carefully. This is the greatest time in the history of the United States, with maybe just a few little exceptions, if at all, that there has been such ambient, almost ubiquitous censorship. So the first thing that comes to my mind and my heart that makes it really heavy is the amount of censorship that we're dealing with here and the control of information. So when questions come out about COVID and this epidemic, this pandemic, and vaccines and the response to this, and what is real and what is not real, what should we do, what should we not do, we have a proliferation now of risk aversiveness and risk aversion by people who would otherwise feel free to voice not simply their opinions, but their scientific knowledge. And we're dealing with the degree of scrutiny and censorship and retribution against people who dare to speak up. So because that is the case, then it makes all other pursuits of truth, and it makes the process of trying to forecast what is the scale and the trajectory and the outcomes of the actions that we're trying to decide upon and undertake, and what will be the overall long-term profile of this pandemic itself. So because of that, it remains a big fuzzy picture. So a lot of what appears to be a solicitation of expert prognostication is often reduced to a matter of what is tolerable personal opinion that they feel a person feels they can say. That's the first thing. Okay? That's a long-winded way of saying we're not dealing with a very honest and open situation in terms of exposure to the public, in terms of what goes into the media, what comes out of the media, and in terms of confidence in the nature of the science and what is reported. So it remains a big black box. As a big black box, however, I think it is pretty consistently understood and surmised that things will likely get worse before they get better.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
And that getting worse is not simply what you might call intrinsically and veritably this virus or this complex of viruses. All of these other aforementioned factors will get worse. Censorship will get worse. Retribution will get worse. Hatred will get worse. Living in fear will get worse. Deaths will get worse. Morbidity will get worse. Quality of life will get worse. Community will get worse. Confidence in government will get worse. Destitution of the infrastructural aspects of family, of community, even of religion and community, clergy, relations, all of these things, all the aspects of our lives are under assault. This is what's going on. Now, yes, it is extremely saddening to hear of General Colin Powell and his passing due to complications of COVID. Every time we hear about someone who is already a very notable person, it seems somehow to hit us a little harder. And certainly as people of color, as minorities, as members of disenfranchised communities and populations, when we hear about one of our own, so to speak, falling by the wayside, we also take it even deeper as a sense of the loss. While at the same time, there is manipulation in that. Because when we hear about someone of notoriety and we tend to have a more personalized or more pronounced sense of loss or sense of impact and effect, what that also is doing is deconditioning us. And it tends to drive us more in a direction of feeling a greater despondency, a greater sense of hopelessness, a greater sense of willingness to give up the last little tiny bit of one's civil liberties or even one's own intelligence, one's own permission to think through things, to see how this is also part of the censorship mechanism, because the other side of the censorship mechanism is what information do you exaggerate or do you actually magnify while you're busy suppressing other types of information. And so we're getting into an overall kind of sense of distortion of things. And just simply to understand that, I mean, to be honest about it, yes. However, General Colin Powell was also dealing with lymphoma, multiple myeloma. Okay, and that is a devastating form of cancer most of the time, particularly when someone's very much into their elderly years, and he's been dealing with immune suppression. So, is it necessarily that he died from COVID, or he happened to die because of his? He happened to die because he had advanced stage of multiple myeloma. He'd be very elderly, and he has a number of other comorbid conditions. And maybe he just happened to also test positive. You see? Now, dying with COVID isn't the same as dying from COVID. However, the distortion
but,
in the
But why is it a tendency? Let's say if someone has a heart attack. You know, I've heard that even though it's a heart attack, they're labeling a lot of these infections and, of course, the deaths on COVID-19. Now, we don't want to prolong this, doctor, but let's hit it and quit, like James Brown said on this one, and we're going to move on and talk about some other things. But what do you think about that, how they're labeling these other forms of death with COVID-19?
It is simply a validation of all that I have just said leading up to this moment that you're asking me the question. Who's controlling the numbers and what weight of what purpose, with what agenda? Now, there have been thousands and thousands of reports of doctors and healthcare workers and family members who have experienced a death. And in the experience of that death, there is this question of what really killed this person. Did this person die from COVID or did this person die with COVID? They died from something else, a heart attack, a stroke, cancer, kidney disease. You see, something else of that sort. And then they're tested, and it positive tests. So then what is the nature of the filling out of the death certificate? What are the statistics that generate, the vital statistics that are generated as a result of that? We already know that there has been countless cases of distortions of that process. And so the numbers on an actual death from COVID is not the same as the numbers of death with COVID. And that distinction has not been made. It has not been made enough systematically, consistently, and uniformly. It has not been done the same way in New York as it was done in Florida and various other places like this. Okay? So we also know that the numbers are serving another purpose. Sometimes it's a convenience purpose of certain aspects of reporting policy implementations. By and large, there's a greater issue, which is the general issue about how these numbers have been reported, have been serving to further exacerbate the angst, the fear, and the division within a collectivity of this population and a global population. So having to be able to say that the number here is X and Y, and that's what it is, and this is the science, and this is the epidemiology, these are biostatistics, and this is the nature of the policy that has to come forth, that has not been a consistent platform from which we have been operating. But it shifts, the numbers shift, the methodology for testing, the cutoffs for what is a positive versus a not positive test, those numbers have been shifted in the methodologies of doing the test and the types of tests that have been insisted upon. Using tests to make diagnoses when the test itself was never intended for that kind of differentiation. It's very, very clear that has been claimed. That has been a massive scandal that has been kept as much as possible in suppression. It's not completely under the wraps, but it's been suppressed about the validity of the PCR test itself. So we already know that, and we already now are starting to see things popping up regarding what is the shedding of virus particles that are infectious from the vaccination campaigns. This is a whole nother big area of things to go. Now, I like to say, hit it and quit. I don't want to get myself deeper into something where next thing you know, my license is gone, all right, or something else like that is happening. But the reality is, it is a dishonest, inconsistent global campaign. Call me a conspiracy theorist if you want. That itself is a term that was invented by the CIA. Okay, it's part of mass disinformation campaigns, part of mass consciousness control. It would be lovely if we all were given true truth. Then we could unify as a global population and how mm-hmm. to deal and how to address these problems. But we haven't been done. And that's just the raw deal, the raw truth.
Right. Well, I appreciate your comments. I kind of, as you said earlier, I kind of feel somewhat attached to General Powell, because I remember attending one of his leadership conferences, and he was just such a dynamic man with a wealth of knowledge, and it seemed effortless. you know, his delivery was just effortless. He's lived it. And so I was very touched by his passing, and many are expressing their sentiments. And we do want to send our sentiments out to the family of our General Colin Powell. But, you know, we're talking about other things. We're going to move on to some of the things that you and I have been talking about. And, you know, so I'm just going to lead off with this, if this is okay with you. What's the difference between Western medicine and alternative medicine?
Okay. I've got to give you a mini, mini lecture, teeny tiny lecture. Usually it takes me about 2 hours to give, but I'm going to try to do that in 5 minutes. Okay, how about that?
Right.
All right. The first thing is really to go into what is the evolution of these terms. Okay. If you go back about 110 years ago, there was something called the Flexner Commission Report. The Flexner Commission was something that was commissioned and under the aegis and the influence of the Rockefeller Foundation. And it was part of a grand scheme to seize control of the healthcare, medical care, particularly the industry, by going after the educational dimension of that industry to make it into a true industry. The Flexner Commission examined all of the medical training institutions that were going on in the United States at that time. And so they had, they found there were schools of medicine for women. There were schools of medicine for black people, for Indian, Native American people. There were all kinds of schools for homeopathy, naturopathy, chiropractic, which started in 1895 with Dr. Palmer in Davenport, Iowa. So we had all kinds of traditional herbalistic, etc., energetic, spiritual type of healing methods and teaching institutions for such. That survey was done, and when it was done, it was found, you know, the numbers were published. What happened shortly thereafter were two major issues. One is there was a whole big of a clampdown. Institutions that were teaching women closed them down. Institutions that were teaching minorities closed them down. Nurse midwifery closed most of that down, except for in areas where, you know, there's no doctor for 150 miles or something like that. And, of course, there were no women doctors at that time, physicians and things of this sort. So what we saw was a narrowing of the playing field to funnel legitimacy into allopathic medicine. And then still some of the others continued to survive, but this created the sort of gold standard being allopathy, Western medicine. And so from there, everything, that became now the emergent new medicine, real medicine. Everything else was considered quackery or some version thereof later that came about to be called alternative.
So are you denoting a Western takeover?
A Western what?
Takeover.
You mean hegemony?
You know, we go, when we look at the East, we see, you know, a lot of homeopathic practices, yes. But as we move to the West, yes. We find, you know, these conventional practices.
Well, this was about creating the business empire that we are dealing with today. Okay, the health, medical, wellness, pharmaceutical, disease creation or disease management empire. This is how it began. So part of what you do in the first stage of that is you take something that is new relativistically, but it's what is intending to it. Engineer the takeover, you have to mobilize a construct of awareness of people or perception of people that is the normal. Okay? So you created the scenario under which this Western medicine mold could ascend to the top of the heap, and then it becomes real medicine. It becomes to be called normal medicine, and eventually it becomes what we call traditional medicine. But it ain't traditional. It ain't been around for a long time. But That's what we do. So everything else then gets to be called alternative or quackery or less than or invalid, you see, or junk. So that's the first phase. And the second phase of which then was, as we can move forward, so the second thing that happened was the institution of the ladder of training, the residency program, Dr. Ochsner in 1910 and at that time at Johns Hopkins, instituting medical residency training. This is basically, it's the old crafts model of an apprentice. You learn enough to get qualified to be treated like a dog. Okay, you were first treated like a slave, now you're being treated like a dog, and then you got to work and sacrifice, but then eventually you work your way through it, now you're treated like a demigod, because next to God is the doctor. Okay, so this created the hierarchy.
Yeah, let me interject this. You know, you're on the slave and the dog. You know, one thing I've noticed in working in a clinical environment that the doctors are working so hard, unbelievably hard, and you know, they almost appear to be a machine at times.
Yes, and this is not simply a recent phenomenon, but I'm trying to give you That's right. I'm not supposed to give you the 3-hour lecture. I'm supposed to give you the 5-minute version. I'm
going
to
give you all right. 5 minutes.
All okay. Right. Let me truncate it more. The point is, you're creating an institution within an industry, and an industry within a sector, and a sector within a global population orientation. Okay. So, because when you're asking the question, what is the difference between traditional medicine and alternative medicine? Well, traditional medicine ain't traditional medicine, first of all right? That was a theft. that's a syntactical linguistic theft.
Right? So in other words, that's what I was alluding to when I said the, you know.
Yes. So you're engineering something as a perspective orientation, that this is real medicine. This is the traditional medicine, and anything else is outside of that. And so if anything is outside of that, it naturally, since this is the real deal, that's got to be worth less in some kind of way. It's less valuable, it's less effective, it's less real, it's less true, it's less scientific. You see? And so that creates this whole mindset. So you create that mindset, legitimize allopathic medicine to try to establish hegemony over all other schools and other training programs and then service delivery environments as much as you can. Say that that's it. That's the reality. Well, that worked fine through the years, through several decades, wars. And then you come out with the baby boomers and you get into the late 50s and the 60s. And you wind up with people now who are starting to look at things from what you might call an alternative perspective, a bit of a rebellious perspective. I'm against the status quo. And so I don't have the same kind of reverence for doctors. I don't have the same kind of obsequious orientation to that kind of authority structure. I want to do something else. So people then started using this term alternative. You started to see how people were then saying, okay, I don't want to go and get that form of treatment. I want an alternative to that. And then also we started to see the emergence of the term holistic. So holistic was often spoken of in terms of those other things. But then gradually holistic began to merge into a commonplace framework of including some of the allopathic. But I can tell you, if you ask 8 out of 10 people off the street who are not in the medical profession, what is an allopath? They wouldn't know what an allopath is. You ask them what is a doctor, and they will tell you what a doctor is, but the idea of a doctor is what really is an allopathic physician. So the allopathic orientation was polarized with other forms, and these other forms were called alternative. But then holistic. But then holistic grew, and that started to also include an overlap with some allopathy. So I want to go to my doctor, and I want to get some sort of basic this, but I also want some of this stuff, this stuff, this stuff. And then And what he saw was the expanding version of the implication of the name of the word holistic. And then that began to merge into something that we call complementary. Complementary medicine
Yes. Was
then more a situation where, if you can think about it in terms of the patient talking to the doctor, okay? I'm talking to you and I'm saying, you know, I don't want this, I don't want this, and I don't want that. I want something else. The doctor at that time would often slam you with this. You don't want my prescription, get out of my office. I don't deal with any of that other stuff. You go find a quack down the road and get your alternative care.
Yeah.
Okay. That became a little bit more liberalized when the doctor would say, okay, listen, I don't want to know about what you're doing down the road. I'm going to handle only this part of it. You bear the consequences if there's something else that's funky that gets put into your healthcare regimen. Then you went to the next phase where the doctors were becoming a bit more concerned, like, what might you be doing down the road? Okay. And so this emerging of complementarity began to show itself as, well, okay, I understand you got some of your grandmama's old remedies, or you got something down there with some chiropractic, you know, they would say chiropractic, you know, or whatever it is, kind of. You know, people would have this, doctors would have these attitudes, okay? Just kind of keep me informed.
I think you just stepped into stand-up on that one. So.
Anyway, that was a spontaneous syntax issue. You know, I got these word issues going on in my head. But it was, okay, keep me informed. Go do some of that stuff, and I just need to know that you're doing something else as well. Later, we began to see that complementarity then became a little bit more, but, well, I'd like to know about what it is that you're doing. I'd also want to understand a little bit of what the substance is that you're doing. Like, if you're taking supplements and stuff, you know, there might be some interaction between the supplement and the drug, and maybe that's not a good interaction. So we started to see some of these emergences of what we would call the proto-complementary medicine stage, where doctors then were starting to learn a little bit more about those other things. Maybe it's body work instead of physical therapy or acupuncture or these other kinds of stuff. So as this started to happen, there was an increasing legitimization of other than allopathic healing and treatment methods. So with this legitimization also came issues of market development. So naturally, what drives things more than anything else in human consciousness nowadays? Money. So the markets for these other modes of treatments began to grow enough that the healthcare industry, the allopathic healthcare, pharmaceutical industry, started to take notice. And some doctors even started to take notice and say, hey, maybe I need to learn more about that stuff, and maybe I can incorporate a little bit of that in my practice. And even some of the big medical organizations started to say, well, hey, we've done a market analysis, and we need to give some attention to the fact that we got a large Asian population, and they do this stuff called Chinese medicine. They do acupuncture. But we got a large Indian or African population, or South American, Latin American population. They have some traditional, but they have some traditional of their own stuff. Maybe we can incorporate a little bit of that in our new wellness program. So you began to see the inroads of what became known as this overriding kind of rubric called integrative medicine.
Yeah. There have been different. I remember visiting Kaiser, you know, for a physical. And that morning I got up and I wasn't thinking. At that time I was drinking coffee. I've stopped drinking coffee. But I drank a cup of coffee and went in for a physical, right? So, you know, they do the workup on you when you first arrive, you know, your vitals, et cetera, et cetera. So the nurse did that, you know, my pulse was a little rapid. And so she says, okay, take some deep breaths, right? So I begin to take the deep breaths, and it didn't come down automatically. So she said, okay, take a few more. So eventually it did come down and I was able to move through that particular regiment, the vitals. I was just at the vitals, not going to medical school. But after the physical, after the doctor had come in and done the physical, the nurse, you know, she was there and she said, I'm going to give you this chart. And it was Dr. Sebi's chart.
Dr. Sebi.
Yeah, Sebi. And she gave me that chart. And, of course, at that time I was drinking something like Simply Lemonade, you know, which is a sugary drink. I didn't drink sodas. The occasional root beer with a hamburger. But, you know, I'm not a soda person. So, you know, I thought I was doing a little better by drinking Simply Lemonade or something like that. And so when I started taking Dr. Sebi's diet or nutritious regimen, I decreased my sugar intake. And I recognized that automatically because I think if you're using sugar, sugar craves sugar. That's one thing. But then, you know, in this regimen, it says don't eat anything but walnuts. If you're going to have a nut choice, eat walnuts. And so I did that. And so, you couldn't eat bananas. So I stopped eating the bananas. And there are several other things to make a long story short. When I began to do it, I shed 20 pounds. 20 pounds. And of course, you know, we're all, you know, looking in the mirror, and if we're not careful, you know, we'll begin to criticize ourselves. And, you know, but 20 pounds, you know, it took a minute for it to shed, but simply eating right, the choices that I made, I wasn't even working out. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So my blood pressure, you know, I don't take any medications. I don't have any chronic health conditions. For an older guy, you know, kind of like you and also Yolanda, you know, older people. So, you know, and you know, so I'm not boasting, but I know the, if you want to call it homeopathic or whatever, it works, you know. And another thing you said the other day is, the body will heal itself, and I've always known that, and I've always practiced that to some degree. So I wanted to interject that because many people are dependent upon this this form of medicine that the West provides. They're dependent because they don't know anymore. But you know, I'm an older guy, and yes, Yolanda, I'm an older guy. So I'm really surprised you're so quiet. Okay.
Not for long.
So, you know, and I think that, you know, your body speaks to you.
Yes.
And one of the things before we get off today, we want to talk about energy therapies also. But we can make our way there. We can make our way there. Later on, at some point, we want to talk about energy therapies, Dr. Melcy.
Yes.
So I'm just interjecting this because perhaps there are people out there listening and they've been trying to make attempts to, you know, better their health one way or another, but they've been addicted to a system.
Right, right. Well, okay, I'll work my way quickly out of my 5-minute on its way to being a 3-hour lecture about the history of these poems.
That's okay. Keep going. I'm learning something. Allopathic, right? Was that
allopathic? It? Yes.
Man,
yes.
I learned a word today.
Okay. Allopathic.
Allopathic.
Oh,
allopathic.
Yeah, allopathic. Okay. It basically means the history of the system of opposites. Allo is the use of opposites.
Is that a combination of holistic and naturopathic?
No, this is the AMA. And Pfizer and Bayer and the University of XYZ's Medical School. This is Western medicine, as right. We understand it. That's allopathic medicine.
Allopathic.
Okay? There's chiropractic medicine. There is naturopathic medicine. There's homeopathic medicine. You see, there are all kinds of systems of approaching the issues of illness, of wellness, of healing, of progression, etc. But the control, the co-opting, the hegemony over the public's perception of what is medicine is basically that 90% of the idea of what is medicine, that spectrum, is taken up by what we call Western medicine. And then there's a little bit of something else over here. And that's a great, great, great distortion. That is a great deception. That's one of the big con jobs of the millennium, because it is basically deactivated and delegitimized almost all other forms of healing, almost all other systems of even understanding illness and disease, along with forms of treatment for such.
Well, isn't it true that one can heal oneself without Western medicine? Can't I decided that I was going to come off of all forms of juices, fruits. I gave up until recently. I gave up sweets. I gave up all fruits. I gave up everything. I lost 39 pounds. My doctor wanted to introduce to me metformin. And she knows metformin is a poison. She knows it is, but she asked me 3 times and I kept telling her, no, I'll do it myself. So I walked all the time. I rode the train to and from work. I walked a mile home. I gave up fruit. I'm just now, within the last maybe 4 or 5 months, reintroducing fruit into my daily regimen. And I only have reintroduced cantaloupe. I think I've probably had 1 cube of watermelon in 6 months. I will not touch fruit juices because they're loaded with sugar. I haven't eaten ice cream or anything dairy in decades. I haven't eaten red meat in decades. No white bread ever. No white sugar, as long as I can stay away from it if I have anything to do with it. So can't people take control of their own bodies through prayer, natural food, a holistic lifestyle, giving up those things that create dis-ease? Isn't mindset also a part of the dis-ease that people have in their bodies? The other part is claiming. When I went through a lumpectomy, I never used the term my. I will never, ever use the term my. It was always a lump that I had, and I had chemotherapy, I had radiation, I had a lumpectomy gone. That was an experience. I didn't claim it. I still don't claim it today. And that was in 2001. So aren't there natural ways of eliminating the dis-ease in our bodies?
It depends on how controversial you want me to fit to be in answering your question, but I can tell you this, a lot of people who step all the way out there and tell you about these natural ways, they are locked away for eternity in boxes below the ground because they have been taken out. So the answer is yes. Okay? The Western medical system is only barely over 100 years of age, 200 years old, so to speak. It's a consolidated industry of the system. Okay? We've had lots of scientific advances. There's great things that are done within this industry, and countless lives are saved every day. Millions of lives are saved every day by the good things that are done. And also, correspondingly, millions of lives are lost or driven closer to death by the way that we create disease on this planet. So the answer to your question in a short sense is yes, we are programmed, we were created, we were given the program of perfect health. We have that within our DNA construct. We have it within our cellular memory. We have it within our biomatrix. At the same time, we have been bamboozled, quote Malcolm, Brother Malcolm, we have been bamboozled.
Hoodwinked.
Hoodwinked.
Tricked.
Tricked. That's right. So what has happened is that we also have been done so in the sense of what we think are viable alternatives. Or even when we want to return to the old ways, because the old ways have been corrupted. Now let us just say, for example, let's say I decide that I'm going to not eat meat, and I'm just going to be a vegetarian. Well, that by itself is an extremely, extremely powerful thing to do. There is hardly a human being on this planet who needs to eat meat. Okay? But we stratify that and say, well, I'm a pescatarian, you know, I'll eat fish and I'll eat, I'm a lacto-ovo and I'll eat poultry and all of this stuff because I need my protein. That all is BS. Okay, the constructs are wrong. The reality is that even if we did shift completely into a vegan diet, we will get certain gains. But unless we could take into other factors into account, we may be exposing ourselves to even more toxins. For example, you go to the market, you want to get that big old giant red apple and bananas or whatever it is, and you think they look so great, so therefore they must be very nutritious. They're carrying less nutrient content than things that are much smaller that you can buy organically. So if you're not factoring in organic food as an important dimension of the food that you're trying to use as your let food be thy medicine, okay, then you may be saying, okay, well, I don't need all of those pills. I'm just going to take food. But what is the nature of the quality of the food that you're taking? So we also have to take that in, you see?
Right.
Because I'll tell you this, one of the most poisonous everyday fruits on the market is a strawberry, is a tossed green salad, because your tossed green salad may have been sprayed with toxic chemicals up to 53 times by the time that you are eating it.
Oh my God.
So if you're not taking that into account, all the pesticides, all the herbicides, all of the fertilizers, all of the other toxic chemicals, all the preservatives, if you're not taking that into account, you think you got this big old healthy salad, so as because it's big and healthy and it's just a salad, I'm going to get a bowl this big, yeah. You know, because I'm eating healthy now.
Free foods.
And there's, you know, you've just contaminated your body with that assortment of chemicals versus what you might get from some other mode of lifestyle that you were dealing with before. So you just have to make sure that the answer to your question is simply, yes, food is thy best medicine when it comes to what we put into our body. Yes, we are programmed to heal anything other than, you know, maybe a piano dropping out of a third-story window and smashing
you up. Oh, God.
But essentially, what we're calling disease states, all disease states are preventable. All disease states are ultimately curable. But we are lagging far, far, far behind the knowledge of what it takes to cure. But even more shady is that we are lagging far behind the presentation of the knowledge to the population. Because there are many, many things that we know how to cure, but we don't promote the curing. We promote the management of the disabling condition.
Yes,
so these
like
are,
the
these
C-word.
Are the other things that are. Yes, these are the other things behind the scene. Now, George, you mentioned Dr. Sebi, for example. Dr. Sebi is an example of someone who's taken a very different approach to understanding healing and treating diseases and curing diseases, the origins of diseases, and what we call the pathophysiology in the body. Well, once he started putting out his stuff and he started to be known and he was actually having results and people were healing, what happened? They came after him.
Yep.
Okay? And eventually they took him out. So
yep.
We understand that. You know, we understand that any major industry is going to do whatever it feels it needs to do to survive as it is. That is the same kind of thing as when somebody has invented a car that can go 300 miles on a quarter of water, gallon of water. Then all of a sudden he's floating up someplace or missing someplace. You know, this is the reality.
You better get rid of that Prius, dude.
So we see that we know that these things are happening. There's nefarity all over the place, but we also at the same time have to recognize what is the good that does come out even from this kind of manipulation and this kind of egregious assault upon the human population. There is a drive that takes place, and it's called adaptability and evolution.
Right. Well, let me interject something here. We have a question. We have two questions. Of course, one is from Kiana, and she's asking, she'd like to know about whether or not birth control stays in the body beyond the conclusion of its use and how to cleanse the body naturally.
Okay. Birth control medications, the hormones that are in birth control have a, you can think of it in a way since then. What is it that is chemically within the body of its impact? And what are what we call the pharmacokinetics, the physiology of it? For how long does, if something is in the body, how long you've been, it's been in the body, how long you've been using it, then how long does it take for it to get out of the body? Okay? So that is a, that's a biochemical, physiological kind of profile to that particular substance, whether it's a drug, a pharmaceutical drug, or whether it's a, you know, it's an addictive drug, an illegal drug. The kinetics of that with respect to generally most of the birth control, the oral, especially contraceptive medications, is that there may be somewhere on the order of 1 to 3 months of what is the traceable biochemical decline, the residue of that within the body. On top of that, however, there is the issue of what does it take for the woman to regain her biorhythms, regain all the switches turn on for her own production processes to come back into harmony and stability. That process can take months, and sometimes even in some women it's taken years. There have been quite a number of women who've been on birth control medication and they had good effects from that, but then when they went off of it after being on it for a long time, it seemed for me for quite a long time before maybe they got back into their what they felt their natural body rhythms, and some women never. Then there is a third issue. The third issue is what you call cellular memory. And cellular memory is not something that Western medicine gives a lot of attention to most of the time. We give attention to it more so when we talk about psychological issues in terms of like a phobic response or PTSD. So I want you to consider the model of what you might call a biochemical or pharmacological PTSD. In other words, the body is subjected to something that causes it to be in an unnatural state. And that unnatural state may be therapeutic with respect to a particular problem that you're trying to treat, but then it has lingering effects at the level of cellular memory. So the body has a hard time trying to getting back to the way it was originally intended to be in its optimal state of function. And so that is, then you go and you test for things pharmacologically, biochemically, and you say, well, the tests are all normal. I don't see nothing in there that tells me that stuff is still in your system. it may be operating at the level of cellular memory, and that cellular memory is a consciousness field issue, and it is not so much a biochemical issue. So there are all of these different layers. It's not quite so simple as just to say, you know, oh, well, if you took it for, if you're on birth control pills for whatever, 3 years, let's just say, and then you get off of it, what's a good amount of time to be extra careful, you know, or to give my body a chance to get it over it? You know, should I use barrier methods, for example, da-da-da? Yeah, you can say 3 months is a reasonable period of time. For most women, I think they'll do fine in terms of getting back into their biorhythms. But that's most, that's not all. And again, it isn't necessarily how much of the chemical remains in the system versus what is the level of the cellular memory. In addition to that, what is the level of the impact upon the consciousness field that is operational at that cellular level so that things restore a better balance and harmony. Recognize that often when people are on hormonal therapies of a number of different types, their body physiology changes and their gross body habitus changes. Often people are on medications and they lose weight or they gain weight and things of that sort. When that is taking place, you also have the secondary effects on the other hormones in your system. So you may have other things that develop as a result of you taking something for one primary issue. And so then you have to look at what is the timetable for those secondary problems that are, or secondary changes that have happened in the body for themselves to get worked out and your body get restored back to its original optimal state.
Okay, thank you. I don't know if you can hit this one and quit really quick, but I remember reading an article about Jewish women. And of course, they eat kosher. It's not vegan, but they eat kosher. But this article was citing that Jewish women, they have a lower percentage of breast cancer than any other women. Had you heard that, or do you know anything about that? That ideology?
A little bit. I know more in general, in this sense, which is to say that that there are a number of population clusters. Well, let's just say cancer incidence of cancer A, cancer B, cancer C, cancer D. There are differences all over the world in any of these kinds of forms of cancer. So that certain populations tend to have a bit more of a certain kind of population, something less of a certain kind of cancer, less of another kind of cancer, whether those are geographic populations or those are genetic populations. You talk about certain things that tend to cluster a bit more in people of this demographic or another demographic. One of the things about kosher food, kosher eating, is it is blending spirituality and biology and life management, nutrition, health, wellness. In general, when you have populations where the eating itself is considered a very important part of your religious and your spiritual life, not just culturally for celebration, but it is considered part of your program for what impacts upon and works with your spiritual practice. And generally, those populations will tend to be healthier. So kosher eating also, in general, tends to lend itself to an advantage over what you might call the general population. Another population sort of like that is like the Seventh-day Adventists, for example. They are vegetarians. And as vegetarians in general, because that is part of their religious practice, there is a mindfulness orientation towards health. And so whenever you have that mindfulness orientation towards health with a deliberateness as to food selection and with an understanding of at least some generalities as to what types of food are better for the body and compared to others, or how foods are prepared and how foods are combined. So koshering is addressing what kinds of foods how foods are compared, are prepared, and how foods are combined, including how foods are sequenced. And all of this is brought into a blessing environment and with a sacrament, a sacredness orientation. This is elevating what we call the mind-body-spirit axis of our connection with our food. And when that is the case, it means that we are activating higher channels of intelligence within our overall biomatrix in order to get the best, the most of the best and the least of the worst out of this experience of bringing something into our bodies.
Okay. Well, our time is far spent, but we want to continue, Dr. Melson, on next time, if I can make that statement. I want to request that you be with us again on the first Tuesday of next month. And we want to talk about mind-body interventions. We want to talk about energy therapies. We want to kind of explore outside the pale orthodoxy to offer, you know, the public alternatives. Because I know just that simple thing, that change that I made a huge difference in my life, of reducing the sugars and not eating this or eating that. And it was effortless. The weight began to just peel off. So with that, thank you so much and appreciate your time. Looking forward to many other episodes. And thank you. We'll see you next time. Yolanda, what do you have with us?
All right. You knew I was going to jump in there. And George, thank you, Dr. Melson. Thank you very much. And I look forward to your next appearance right here on the Intentional Program. You've been listening to Your Life, Your Health, sponsored by Central Nature Health Promotion, with offices located at 714 West Boulevard, 801 in Los Angeles, California, 90015. For additional information on CNHS Clinics, please visit cnhsclinics.org, and that's info at cnhsclinics.org. You can also visit our social media sites at Central Nature Health Foundation at facebook.com or cnhf_clinics at Instagram. And please, we're still in COVID. Don't forget there's COVID-19 testing at the Central Clinic Monday through Thursday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. And at the Inglewood Clinic Monday through Thursday, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. And don't forget the CNHF Food Pantry. It's on the first and third Mondays of each month, 10:30 a.m., located at Grand Avenue, LA. That clinic is 2614 South Grand Avenue in Los Angeles. And that's 90007. And remember, until next time, it's been your life, your health. And thank you for joining us.